This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour, a conversation about management with a government executive who is changing the way government does business. The Business of Government Hour is produced by the IBM Center for the Business of Government, which was created in 1998 to encourage discussion and research into new approaches to improving government effectiveness. You can find out more about the center by visiting us on the web at businessofgovernment.org. And now, the Business of Government Hour.
Welcome to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host and managing editor of the Business of Government magazine. The U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs may be the second largest federal agency, but it runs the largest medical system in the United States, providing medical care to over 22 million veterans and their families who depend on it. This is no small feat considering the demands placed upon the system. To meet these demands head-on involves leveraging innovation and advances in technology. How is VA identifying new technologies and promoting innovation? What is the Blue Button Initiative? And how is VA using open source technology to meet its mission? We will explore these questions and so much more with our very special guest, Dr. Peter L. Levin, Senior Advisor to the Secretary and Chief Technology Officer at the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. Welcome to the show, Peter. It's great to have you.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm glad you're here. It's going to be an interesting conversation. I'd like to set some context around our conversation first, and that really requires us to get a brief overview and history of the mission of the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Absolutely. Well, there's two primary missions. One of them is to deliver the best possible clinical medical services to injured, wounded, ill veterans, or veterans that have chronic care management issues. So we provide the best care anywhere. We really believe in that mission. It's something that we take very seriously. The second one is, of course, the delivery of veteran benefits, so service-connected disabilities, home loans, education benefits. I'd be neglectful if I didn't say that there was a really important third mission, which is to provide internment with honor, right? And it tends to be a neglected aspect of who we are and what we do. But here's something you may not know, and most people don't. The National Cemetery Administration is the highest rated customer service organization of any institution in the country. Not just any institution of its kind, any institution in the country. It beats out all the computer electronic or consumer electronic folks that you know. It beats out all the auto manufacturers that you know. Beats out everybody. And you say, well, why is that? I mean, sometimes people make some morbid jokes about, you know, who the customer is. But it's not morbid at all. It's the families of the people who are being buried. It's the families of the folks that are going through an extraordinarily difficult, extraordinarily emotional time. And they come back to us and they tell us how much they appreciate what we do. So it's running the nation's largest hospital system, it's delivering benefits to 3 million veterans, and it's interring people with honor.
That's wonderful. How do you do this? And what I mean by that is a scale of operation. What's the size of the budget and the number of folks that work for the VA?
Yeah, so rough order of magnitude, it's about $135 billion. It's well over 300,000 employees. I think if you included our contractors, we'd be up to around 330,000 employees. Second largest government agency, the largest civilian agency. The way I like to explain it is about one in every 10 federal employees works for VA, either, you know, in our benefits administration, you know, processing claims in the hospitals, providing some kind of clinical services from the doctors, nurses, and the administrators there, or working in the National Cemetery Administration.
Well, thank you for that context. It really helps us. I want to turn to your role. Yeah. As Senior Advisor to the Secretary and Chief Technologist for VA. Yeah. Could you tell us a little bit about the office? What's the genesis? What created the office or your role? What's some of your responsibilities? And what's a day in the life of a Chief Technologist?
Boy, it's exciting. I tell you, it's the best job I've ever had. Beyond the privilege of being a presidential appointee, beyond the opportunity of working with people like Eric Shinseki and Scott Gould and John Gingrich and Roger Baker literally on a day-to-day basis, beyond beyond the I would say the transcendent moral cause of our mission, taking care of the people who take care of us, it's really just a tremendous amount of fun, and I think that we're making a difference. So A Day in the Life is complicated and wild, and I'm lucky because I'm dual hatted, right? So the senior advisor role, I would say, is a traditional role in government. You'd find this in any of the agencies. The chief technology officer role is new to the Obama administration. He appointed the very first federal CTO. That was Anish Chopra, and today that slot is occupied by Todd Park. And I've worked very closely with both of these guys in this newly created CTO role at VA. And now if you looked at energy, education, justice, and practically all of the cabinet agencies now have somebody, either a career individual in that slot or in many cases a newly created political appointee in that slot. And really what they're doing is they're using the opportunity to have someone whose mission is only to create value inside of that agency for a couple of years, right? So you're unencumbered in terms of career progression. You're unencumbered in terms of sort of living inside what can be sometimes sort of the narrow constraints of the old way of doing business, right? And so, you know, I don't want to in any way imply that we're not doing things by the rules. We're doing everything by the rule. But I get to ask the hard questions. I get to ask the risky questions. I get to fail, right, in ways that sometimes other folks wouldn't feel comfortable with or, frankly, wouldn't feel empowered. So the first thing that I do, there's a sign on my door. It says, all people who need empowerment find it here. The first answer out of my mouth is yes. And then we figure out how to get what it is that folks are asking for. This is a direct instruction from Secretary Shinseki. In literally my first day on the job, he pulls all the new political guys, especially the guys he didn't know well. We were new to him at that time. And he says, look, here's the deal. I'm the only guy in the administration who can say no. I'm the only guy in the agency who can say no, right? So your job is to say yes. And that's, I tell you, that's a mission I take pretty seriously. You know, 4-star general, chief of the army, you just follow instructions, right? You just do what he says to do. And I find that that's a very, very successful strategy for me. So the CTO role is about exploring the boundaries of new technology. It's about exploring the boundaries of new problems, problems that some folks say, well, you just have to live with that. You just have to suffer underneath it, or you just have to kind of ignore it and hope it goes away. I get to say, well, geez, why is it that we don't have automated claim system? Why is it that veterans can't get their electronic medical records? Why is it that we don't have suicide prevention chat line for the folks that don't feel comfortable or don't want to call the agency? And then we can start walking through those questions. That's about half of my job. The other half of my job is serving, I would say, as a traditional senior advisor role, confidential actions, personnel issues, making sure that the boss is well prepped for whatever meeting that he has, creating sort of the frame or the ambit of the discussions that we may have interagency within the agency. It's 300,000 people. A lot of folks need to talk to the boss sometimes, or occasionally outside of government. And I love that too. It's sort of like a glorified speechwriter. That's a fun part of my job.
Well, you kind of alluded to it when you described the CTO, but I'd like to get an understanding of how the chief technology officer or chief technologist differs from, say, or works in complement to the chief information officer.
Yeah, that's a great question. I get that question a lot. So Roger Baker is our rock star CIO. He's arguably the most effective CIO in government today, right? And why is that? Well, first of all, he brings in an extraordinary operational expertise. He's worked in a variety of different industries. He's worked in sort of mainline government service, defense contractors to startups, right? And he's bringing in sort of an operational implementation technology transfer role. And I would say, if he were sitting here, I would say, oh yeah, there's a huge difference between Peter and me. I've got 7,000 people working for me, and Peter's got like 4, right? And it's true. My job, in contrast, is really to serve as a complement to that. I consider sort of myself an enabler to the kinds of things that he needs to get done. Bandwidth extension, you know, to put it in rather unprosaic terms. And there's just some things that he can't get to. As smart as he is, as capable as he is, there, you know, it's my job to sort of step out a little farther on the vanguard of what's out there and what's possible and sort of negotiate that process with this 7,000-person IT organization.
Well, I'd like to understand some of your top management challenges or challenges in your role? And I'm not too sure you would consider them challenges, probably more like opportunities, if I can glean. What are they?
The number one challenge that I have is the ability to, or the opportunity to get folks out of the mindset of why it won't work and why they can't do it to how it could work and why they would try, right? Here's my experience. You have some folks in government service who approach it the way that I would approach any job and approach it certainly with the way that is familiar to me as a private sector guy. And they're coming in, they're saying, heck yeah, we're going to do that. And heck yeah, we're going to try that. And absolutely, they have 15 better ideas to the one that I have, right? And what they're waiting for, it's almost like the example I use is like a sommelier, right? Yeah. The guy who opens up the wine at the French restaurants. I've just described to you my job in a sentence, right? You know, so my job is to uncork that enthusiasm, uncork that risk-taking, uncork that energy, and push people into doing things that they otherwise wouldn't have necessarily tried because they didn't know that they had the political air cover, the professional air cover, or frankly, the emotional air cover to say, hey, you know, I don't care if you fail, just, you know, do it tomorrow, right? You know, just, you know, imbue that sense of urgency with the process that we're trying to follow. So my biggest challenge is to have exactly this conversation where you have people who don't feel empowered, who are fearful. If I had to explain it, I would explain it the way I just did. Empowerment to performance, empowerment to accountability, and bridging that gap. And I love it. Yeah. I just love it. It's the most fun part of my job.
So I did have one last question for this segment, and that is, given your background, what makes an effective leader? What are some of the characteristics you've seen that really define an effective leader?
By far, the most important characteristic is truth-telling, right? Including hard truths, absolute perfect transparency. I would say the folks that work with me and for me that I'm the most effective partner for would say that about me, including the bad truths, including the, hey, that didn't work out so well, or hey, I'm disappointed, or hey, that wasn't the standard that we were hoping to achieve together. There's a close second, which I've touched on already, which is the ability to empower, right? The ability to say, if you do that and it doesn't work, I've got your back. Right. If you do that and you end up tipping over somebody else's rice bowl, or it costs a little bit more than we thought it was going to cost, or it takes a little bit longer than it's going to take, but we can demonstrate that you're making regular, steady, transparent, accountable progress, and you know that I'm supporting you, as long as people understand that you're going to be absolutely exquisitely transparent on the one hand, and on the other hand, perfectly protective. Then the last element, at least for me, is to make sure that they understand that they're going to get the credit, right? Right? Truth-telling, accountability, and proper assignment of credit, man, you can't go wrong.
How is VA identifying new technologies and promoting innovation? We will ask Dr. Peter L. Levin, Senior Advisor to the Secretary and Chief Technology Officer at the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. How can we enhance national competitiveness? What about getting big things done in government? And how can government better manage risks and use resources more wisely? Pick up the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine and find out. Hear from Comptroller General Gene Dodaro, SSA Commissioner Michael Astrew, Coast Guard Commandant Admiral Robert Papp, NGA Director Tish Long, and Aaron Connaughton on the Air Force's strategic vision. All of this and so much more in the latest edition of the Business of Government magazine. Order your free copy at businessofgovernment.org. Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Dr. Peter L. Levin, Senior Advisor to the Secretary and Chief Technology Officer at the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. So, Peter, your job is to identify new technologies and sort of push the envelope a little bit in order to save time, realize some cost savings as well with these technologies, and most of all, benefit the veteran in any way and their families in any way you can. To that end, could you tell us a little bit more about your technology innovation strategy? And maybe are there foundational principles that sort of spur this along?
There are. So the technology and innovation strategy, at least in the way that I think about it, and I think that every person or every technologist has sort of their own model. And I'm really fortunate this way because, you know, I've done some work in the semiconductor world. I've done some work in applied mathematics, you know, sort of the more theoretical, more esoteric side, and a little bit of work in cybersecurity. Now, that's not just sort of, you know, a parade of technologies. I share that in the spirit of having a pretty broad purview of the kinds of problems that one encounters today as we're really hitting an inflection in IT, in the kinds of problems that we now think can be addressed with information technologies and with this horribly overused term called big data. So the way that I approach this, at least, is when somebody brings me a new opportunity, when somebody brings me a problem, I try to fit it into a framework, right? I try to say, okay, so is this a device issue which becomes a hardware issue, which becomes a qualification issue? Or is this a data liquidity issue which becomes an access issue, which becomes a quality of service issue, right? And I can sort of walk you through maybe six or seven of those opportunities where I have this framework that I've been able to assemble and accumulate over, gosh, you know, 30 years now, right? Where I say, oh, I know that looks like this kind of problem. Or I've read an article where somebody had a similar question, and I can very quickly put it into a context and a framework, right? The next thing I like to do is I like to feed it back. I say, so you can imagine, especially somebody who's just so expert and so entrenched and drenched in the problem that they're trying to solve. You know, maybe it's in nutritional sciences. It's a new project. Or maybe it's in, you know, how do I make radiological images available on tablets, right? You know, some of these things are, you know, kind of in the weeds, but they're hugely important when you look at the cost, the quality, the access, and the satisfaction of our veterans and of our service providers. So I'm lucky that I can map practically any problem you throw at me somewhere in that framework and connect it to things that either that I know that are going on already at the VA or that I know that are going on in the private sector. It's been a huge benefit to me, and I'd like to think that it's been one of the secrets, one of the ways that we've been able to move the ball forward a little bit.
And I'd like to unwrap some of those initiatives you've been successful at pursuing. I think it's true to say that you noted that it is key not to map technology to needs, but to map needs to technology.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
To that end, your initial project that you took up was around mental health services.
Yes.
And improving them.
Yes.
For the VA. Could you tell us a little bit about that project?
Absolutely. So this is a project that was actually spearheaded by Jan Kemp and by Sonia Batten, two people who I consider sort of my closest collaborators at VA. It's not widely known, but it's true that it was actually one of the reasons why I asked to go to VA, right? I didn't know that I was going to be working on claims processing. I learned about that when I got there. And I was sort of vaguely interested in this whole notion of electronic medical records because I'm a parent, right? Because I always thought it was stupid that I was keeping track of my kids' immunization records in a paper file, or when I was really ambitious on a Sunday afternoon, I would type it into an Excel spreadsheet, which I didn't always do, so that made it incomplete and therefore useless, right? And so the thing that I wanted to work on, and I thought that I would be spending more time on it than I actually have, was mental health services generally and suicide prevention specifically. I think that we don't understand enough about that. I think that it's stigmatized. I think that it's especially stigmatized in this population. And this part of my trajectory, this part of my life began with a phone call to another four-star general, a really famous guy who has been a mentor to me for very many years. Now, suicide, as you might know, is an endemic problem in the United States right now, right? It's not particular to veterans. But when veterans have this problem, it's something that we can do something about as long as they're in our system, as long as we can touch them, as we know who they are. They have to identify themselves. So I don't want to make it sound like, oh, jeepers, this is only something if you wore a uniform. It happens tragically far too often, even if you never served in the armed forces. But the folks that we talk to are the guys that contact us with a telephone, whether they're wearing a uniform now or whether they just took it off recently and stepped back into the private sector. But they have to take the first step. We have to know that they need the help. We have to know that they're in distress. And gosh, I'm just so proud of the ones that step forward and say, you know, I'm having an emotional feeling. I'm feeling depressed. I'm feeling distressed. I'm feeling desperate. And I know enough to know that this is not normal. And I know know enough to know that I can get help for this. All that to say that there was something that we weren't doing that I thought we could do better. And that Jan Kemp had already thought of, which was the situation where somebody isn't comfortable to make a phone call. They're not comfortable because they're worried about the phone number being traced. They're not comfortable because they don't like to speak. There are a lot of people who are shy and they just don't like to talk. They're perfectly happy to chat, but they don't like to talk. Or they don't want to do it because they're afraid that they're going to be overheard. Right. And the last one is really kind of a serious problem because people do listen. Right. You know, your muffled voice and all of a sudden, geez, what are you saying? Right. And so Jan had this idea to create a chat service. Right. And, you know, even as recently as 3 years ago, that was a little kind of on the edge. Right. You know, why would you do that? And, you know, the people, you know, my kids knew what chat was, but I wasn't doing it. Right. I do it now, of course, but. And she said, well, look, we have this capability. The technology is there. It's not very expensive and it's highly secure. But she was being blocked, you know, by the bureaucracy and by the qualifications and the certifications and the phase of the moon and whether it was cloudy outside, right? It just, you know, she was being blocked by a lot of things that didn't make sense. So the first project that I worked on, literally in the first month, I can tell you the day that we went live. It was July 3rd, 2009. And we turned on that internet chat service. And fast forward to today, we have over 6,000 interventions, right? Now, that's, I'm not talking about just the chats that we have every time somebody, you know, misdialed us or, you know, they weren't, let me say, weren't looking for suicide prevention services. They were looking for something else, right? I'm talking about the where we have an intervention, where we handed it off, where we have a truck roll, where we did something active and proactive to help that individual in distress. In my faith tradition, if you save one, you've saved the world, right? All those things are hugely important, but nothing is more important to me than those couple of folks that are with their families today because of what Jan did a couple of years ago, and where I got to kind of help push it across the goal line a little bit.
The other thing, as you just mentioned, is the Blue Button Initiative.
Yes.
Can you tell us a little bit about that and what prompted your efforts in this area?
That's a hysterical story. So, I'll do sort of the highlights. This is like body surfing for me. I love telling this story. Okay, so first of all, the Blue Button was born at a meeting at the Markle Foundation in January of 2010. And who's sitting around the table? Carol Diamond, Clay Shirky. I mean, give me a break, right? Todd Park, Linda Fischetti, Kim Nazi, Susanna Fox, Alan Bodsworth. I wish I could name everybody. I don't remember them all. And we start talking about this idea of, well, how do we make health records available to people. The idea of creating a very, very simple ASCII file was something that I had been thinking about for a while because I do have kids, right? And because, you know, I've been very, very lucky in my health history, but, you know, I don't remember every medicine I ever took. And how hard could it be? And Linda and Kim were there and they were like, yeah, we can do that. We'll just take that on. And we get back to the VA and I'm reporting to the secretary, you know, what had happened at this meeting and why actually, you know, I kind of went up there reluctantly and I came back and it was this fireball, right? You know, it's like, we got to do this and we could be the first ones. And it ties so nicely into the president's initiative of the Virtual Lifetime Electronic Record, right? The VLER project, right? And so what's VLER? VLER is about creating a health record from the time you raise your hand to ascension, you know, through your military service, through your post-military service, through your private sector life, literally until the time that you're interned. Everything medically that we can possibly know about you and bluntly that you want us to know about you can be in one place. Well, you know something? That's a hard problem. And it's got to start someplace. And so I'm explaining this to the secretary, and he's like, I said, look, it's not going to be the complete medical record. It's not going to be clinically valid, and it's not going to be comprehensive. It's going to be a few things that I can get my hands on, and then we'll see where it goes, right? And he kind of looks at me, and he's kind of, I don't know if you know the secretary at all, but he's got this smile about him. He's like, you know, and you think, uh-oh, what did I just sign up for? And he's like, okay, Peter, good. You know, and by the way, zero budget, you know, talk people into doing this for you with my blessing. And then he kind of looks at me and he says, how many people do you think you're going to get? Right. Okay, I wasn't expecting that question. I just figured out quick yes or no. Can I get started on this? And I pulled a number out of the sky. And I said, okay, 25,000, right? So how did I pick 25,000? Well, I figured First of all, it's a big enough number that it would get his attention, right? If I say 300, he's going to be like, why are you in my office? And if I say 3 million, he's going to say you're lying, right? Okay, so 25,000 sounded good, right? We grew so quickly because of the enormous overarching need of people to get their health information. And they were willing to take a cruddy ASCII file that was incomplete just to be able to pull something down and say that they had at least that. They could edit it any way they wanted. They could augment it any way they wanted. And we watched them do this. So fast forward today, 2 years later, the blue button, just this last weekend, we had a new release, I think our 27th or 28th data chapter. We're reaching into the Vista system and pulling out things like immunization records, pulling out things like medications, pulling out things like allergies. The second thing that we're going to do, and this is a close cooperation between myself and Farzad Mostashari, the director in the Office of the National Coordinator, we're going to make this whole thing available to everybody. So if you look at who has signed on to our health informatics initiative, Aetna, United Health, Blue Cross, Kaiser, right? Now, some of these folks are doing this for all of their subscribers, like United Health is something we're enormously proud of. We have over a million users today. 1.2 million users. As Todd and Farzad like to say, you know, one down, 313 to go. It's a large addressable market.
Switching gears a bit, I'd like to talk a little bit about your efforts around claims backlog.
Yeah.
VBA claims backlog. Yeah. As I understand it, I think it's 1.5 million by 2015 if things aren't handled better. Yeah. What are you doing and how are you helping to tackle this issue?
Sure. So first of all, let's honor the problem, right? But let's not admire it. Let's just acknowledge that we've got one. If we don't take this moribund, manual, archaic system. I mean, you can't make this up. I'm finding white boxes underneath people's desks and they're afraid to turn them off because there's like some system that helps process claims that nobody ever uses anymore is underneath somebody's desk and they're not quite sure what to do about that. To answer your question more directly. Well, the first thing we can do is we can provide web services so that when you actually apply for a claim, it's just easier. You're not filling in paper forms. You've got an electronic copy someplace. It gets lost. You've made a mistake. You have new information. There's a change in your name. 1,000 things. Can we please like at least automate the processing? Fast forward to today. We have delivered the first web-based automatic claims processing system. So we have demonstrated you can scan, you can apply online, and you can automate the decision system, right? We only did it for a couple of claims, but we kind of laid the groundwork. Here's what the user interface looks like for the claims processor. Here's what the user interface looks like for the veteran who's applying for that claim, right? We've connected those to payment systems so that you can actually write a check. But the problem is, and it's not actually a problem, it was the existence proof. It was the prototype. It was the place that we started. And we knew that we had to grow and make it much more robust. We had like 2 of 71, right? It ends up that when you start processing the other 69, the calculation of what a veteran is entitled to ends up becoming nonlinear, right? So if you've got condition 13, 6, and 7, it's different than if you've got condition 34, 54, and 61, right? You know, and oh, by the way, maybe you have, you know, one or more. So there's all these combinations. And right, yeah, that's a hard problem. It's no wonder it takes so time.
So, Peter, the Veterans Integrated Systems Technology Architecture, or VISTA, which is VA's electronic health record, has a robust capability, specifically its clinical applications. I'd like to know about how you're moving it into the 21st century. In particular, would you elaborate on VA's efforts to migrate VISTA to an open source platform?
I'll give you a very specific example. Literally on my first day of work also, Roger and I are sitting in the office and we're starting literally to kick the can around, you know, what can we do in health record modernization, right? So VA runs what is still arguably the best electronic medical record system in the United States. Still today, the thing is, 15 years old, and it's at least in the majors, right? You know, you can say, well, you know, this commercial product is better or this private sector or a public sector product is better. They may have aspects that are better. There's nobody better when it comes to the full-on integration. And yet it's not good enough. If you look at where we are with this tightly coupled, proprietary, customized code, it's very difficult to maintain. It's very difficult to extend. And God forbid you should find a bug, right? Because I mean, we've literally pulled people out of retirement to say, hey, this thing doesn't work anymore. Can you help us, right? So he and I start talking about, well, look, it's already in the public domain. People can already take Vista down, and there are folks that are doing this, I mean, and they're making good money at it as well. So, you know, the taxpayers have paid for it. We make the code available, and then you get enterprising entrepreneurs who then start deploying it to hospitals and clinics, right? And they're providing – their value add is the service that they provide. So great. What can we do not only to make Vista more attractive to the public sector, but now here comes the punchline. How do we start bringing things back in from the private sector, from the folks that are making extensions, from the folks that are doing things with Vista that we can't do ourselves that we should be benefiting from? So another way of looking at this is every time we want to create an extension, I don't know, the famous one is sort of our scheduling package, just to pick an example. There's pharmacy, laboratory, radiology, you know, all the things, the 50-some things that you find in a now conventional electronic health record system. How do we take that innovation that you easily find in the public sector and pull it back in into this open source platform? Well, there's two huge advantages of it. First of all, we are not taking the risk. We're not risking taxpayer money or patient safety to do it that way, right? This is a fantastic thing. We know by the time we're pulling these things back in that they work already. They're out there already. They're already interoperable with our system. The question is, how do we get access to them? Second of all, it ends up being a procurement question, right? And you can imagine the guys, the purveyors of these large, monolithic, integrated systems, you know, they're let me say, a little uncomfortable now, right? Or the folks that are selling services to the government, but they sell them in a proprietary, highly customized way. They're thinking, well, jeepers, are you trying to turn my business model over? And the answer is actually no. The answer is what we want are openly architected, standards-based modular systems. If we get openly architected standards-based modular systems, we're opening the aperture. In fact, we're creating a much fairer basis of competition. So all that to say, and by the way, conversation you and I are having right now is the conversation I had with Roger Baker on my first day of work, right? Okay. And so how do you solve this problem? Well, fast forward to 1 year ago, October 2011, we go live with the open source custodial agent, right? So we've now created, government has created a nonprofit company. We launch it into the wild and we say, hey, listen, we need Vista to be refactored. There's a technical term, right? We need Vista to be easier to maintain, easier to sustain, easier to extend. So we can put all those requirements out. We need, as it ends up, we need a new scheduling package, right? So and in order for you to now sell to the VA, you have to prove to us that you are going to be compatible with the open source version before we even have a conversation with you, right? So or before we even write you a check, right? So the open source custodial agent is called OSERA, OSEHRA, and you'll find their website, osera.org. It's chaired by the former Secretary of Veterans Affairs, a guy named Jim Peek. He's also the former Surgeon General of the Army, right? You know, so somebody we think is eminently qualified, right? And then it's co-chaired by a guy named John Halomka, who's arguably sort of the nation's leading light when it comes to health informatics and electronic health records. And those are the two guys that serve the executive chair roles inside of OSERA. And then I could kind of walk you through the roster of the, you know, 1,000 people that have signed on in 1 year, the 125 companies that have signed on in 1 year, the way that OSERA now is starting for the first time ever. We've actually pulled code down from OSERA, a user interface that was created as part of the Integrated Electronic Health Record Project, this thing that we're doing together with the DOD. We've pulled down code and we've installed it in a clinic, right? And so if you follow the argument and say, well, good. So you created this open source platform based on a public domain code. You've created the governance and procurement mechanisms to get things back into the inside, and you did it once. That's huge, right? Okay, so we can spend the next hour talking about what that really means.
Well, just switching gears a bit, how else are you using open source technology at VA? And more particularly, how does it assist you in your efforts going in the open direction?
I'll tell you why we do open source, because we're more secure and because it's cheaper in the long run. Okay, now what does that actually, how does that translate into what we're doing at the VA? Translates in a lot of ways. Mostly in the area of electronic health records, right? The claims processing piece, it ends up, it seems surprising. You could always use open source components. You can use open source front ends. You can use open source operating systems. There are all kinds of places where it finds purchase there. What we're trying to do is fundamentally reform an existing piece of production software, right? And the way that you do that, the best is to make sure that you've got sockets that you can plug these modules into. It's a horribly overused analogy, but it really is like your smartphone. You know, there's an app for getting a restaurant. There's an app for getting a taxi. There's an app for making an appointment or finding the weather or seeing what the latest congressional vote is, getting the news. And what we want is to find the analogy to all those things. There's an app for radiology. There's an app for immunizations. There's an app for pediatrics. There's an app for nursing, right? And what we have today in the United States, it's not unique to VA or to the DOD, what we have are these stovepiped applications that by design kept you captive. And what the government can do, what the government can uniquely do is establish a framework, establish a pattern, if you will, that says, listen, we have veterans who get half of their care outside of our hospitals. We must find a way for patient safety, if for no other reason, even if it wasn't more secure, even if it wasn't cheaper, which it is. But even if those two things weren't true, you've got a transcended patient safety issue, and you need to make sure that those data at least are interoperable, apropos blue button, or you need to make sure that the systems are interoperable, apropos Vista and the IHR project. So we're attacking this really at both fronts. So what we're doing is we're taking, if you can imagine, the platform, the thing that says, oh, okay, so Peter has shown up today and he's got a sore throat and we're going to prescribe him some penicillin and we're going to call him in 2 days, right? So when you describe that use model, it ends up that you can actually, in a very analytical way, put that into software components that do all of those things and that communicate with each other. And every element that I've just described, that little workflow that I just described, I showed up, I got to register, I got to see a doc, he's going to put a stick down my throat and look at my throat. He's going to decide that I'm taking penicillin when I go home and his nurse is going to call me in a few days. All of those things represent applications, and there's you know, millions of them, right? Probably a million different permutations of the use model. All of them can be accommodated with open source components, right? What the government wants is the ability to plug that app into a standard socket and to use it, and we'll figure out what the business looks like later. I'll pay you every time. I'll give you a couple pennies every time I use it, or I'll buy a year's worth of licenses, and you're not going to, you know, care how often I use it. Whatever that business deal is, all I care about is that interface. And as far into that stack, as far into the immunization package, the radiology package, the anesthesia package, that I can go, sure, not because I'm greedy, but because I'm trying to make it standard.
How is VA embracing social media, and what other emerging technologies are on the horizon? We will ask Dr. Peter L. Levin, Senior Advisor to the Secretary and Chief Technology Officer, when our conversation continues on the Business of Government Hour. The IBM Center for the Business of Government has recently published Governing to Win, Enhancing National Competitiveness Through New Policy and Operating Approaches, edited by Chuck Pro, which brings together insightful essays by leading thinkers and practitioners that offer a long-term strategy to improve national competitiveness. How can our nation better compete in today's global economy? And how can moving to an Enterprise USA approach in government enhance our national competitiveness? This book explores these questions and so much more. Governing to Win is available at bookstores, online booksellers, and from the publisher, RomanLittlefield.com.
Why is fiscal stability integral to national competitiveness? How can moving to an Enterprise USA approach in government enhance national competitiveness? Join host Michael Keegan and contributors to the IBM Center book, Governing to Win, next week on a special edition of the Business of Government Hour, and find out.
Welcome back to the Business of Government Hour. I'm Michael Keegan, your host, and our guest today is Dr. Peter L. Levin, Senior Advisor to the Secretary and Chief Technology Officer at the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. So, Peter, social media is ubiquitous. Many platforms, folks engaging in whatever platform they seem to be particularly interested in. I'd like to understand your view of how you're using social media to connect with employees and constituents, and perhaps you could illustrate some success stories.
One of my most favorite stories of the last 3.5 years is a social media story. So just to make sure that you and I are kind of in the same frame of reference here, you know, so we use this to communicate with our stakeholders, sort of, you know, an alternative channel. It happens to be a digital channel. We use this to get ideas from our employees, right? And we also use this to engage, not in a almost like email, right? You know, say asynchronously. You don't know exactly when I'm going to read it. I don't know exactly when you're going to read it, but we can start at least having the beginning of a dialogue that we may want to pull off of the social media onto a more conventional platform, whether it's like real email where you can write more or a telephone call, right? So we're doing all of those things. One of the first projects that I did now 3 years ago was to ask our employees how to solve the backlog problem. Right? Okay. So the first thing you should know is nobody had ever actually asked before, right? So here you are with these guys working, you know, as much as 60 hours a week. You know, these are, you know, GS7s to GS9s. They're not making a ton of money, right? They're schlepping files back and forth. They're using cruddy computer screens, sometimes just one, with, you know, mounds of paper around them trying to process a claim. And so you might think in this age of ubiquitous personal computing and fast internet that they go home and they think, Jesus, I wish I had this capability at work, at least a piece of it. So we, in a very structured, very organized way, we went to this was actually the first VA innovation project. This is the first project of this organization that's now run by Jonah. And we said, how would you solve this problem, right? And we segmented it up in sensible ways. And then my favorite category was the Babe Ruth category. I said, swing for the fences. I realize that we may not have asked the questions the right way. I'm not a claims processing guy. I don't know what I don't know. So in the event that you have an idea that doesn't fit snugly into one of those four categories, here's the and everything else category. And those were always the best ones, right? Those are the craziest ones. Those are the ones that I like the most. And we bring in people like Craig Newmark, Craig from Craigslist, and he's one of the judges, right? And you get to meet Craig if you're one of the finalists. And so we're using social media in that way, right? You can imagine the hue and cry. You know, people are going to have, you know, gender or racial or lifestyle slurs. People are going to put up their social security numbers. They're going to complain about their boss. Dogs and cats will live together. The earth will break in 5 pieces if you do this, right? It didn't happen. It didn't happen. This is ties snugly to something that I said a few minutes ago, right? We have this, you know, conception like if you empower people, they're going to abuse it and hit you back, right? And I don't want to say it never happened, but here's what didn't happen. You have a 20,000-person agency, the VBA, and we had a couple of people who spent a little bit of time making sure that we were in the guardrails of things that you would be outraged if you heard it on the street or if you saw it on TV. It didn't happen one time. Somebody mistakenly put a social security number in. I think that it was like, you know, it was in their buffer and they hit control C and didn't realize it. It was like completely non sequitur to anything, right? It was gorgeous, right? So that there's an example where we're really trying to empower our employees. It's sort of one of the themes of our conversation today. There we got to do that really in the first couple months. If you look at our Facebook account, this is an initiative that was led at that time by Tammy Duckworth and then by Brandon Friedman. And today it was sort of institutionalized inside of the VA. We went from zero. We had no Facebook presence. And God forbid, you were not allowed to even use it on your desktop. Why would you do that? You know, you might be goofing around. We would never let you touch it. To the most friended cabinet agency, we went from zero to hero in the course of like a year. hundreds of thousands of subscribers, and we use this as a mechanism of communication. We've got an appointment announcement, got an important press announcement, stuff that you wouldn't put in a press announcement that allows people to kind of understand in a more granular way what's going on that they otherwise couldn't see. Here's my favorite story. So I look at the Facebook account, right? And I was, you know, sort of the CTO, crazy guy, wild hair, thick glasses, you know, loud voice. And I said, we are so doing this. We are absolutely doing this. You know, I was like lobbying in a pup tent outside the secretary's office until I got him to say yes, right? You know, it's really, really serious about it. And I look at it and I see what kind of comments, because they're really concerned. And you know, something, we don't always get just compliments from veterans about how we're doing, right? And there was this guy who just seemed more balanced than everybody else. Like his complaint was something I felt like I could personally do something about. So I pull him off the Facebook page and I say, hey, man, what's really going on here? That guy's name is Randy Watson. Randy Watson and I have become good friends. And Randy Watson was one of the first ever users of Blue Button. I got him to test it out. So when I want to know what's really going on in the field, when I want to know what a veteran really sees, when I want to know what a veteran really does with this information, I ask Randy. So it's a silly story. It's a single story. It doesn't scale in any way, but this is a Vietnam veteran who earned his benefits, who gets all of his health care from the VA, and was one of our first users. So we schlepped him in from Joplin, Missouri a couple of weeks ago. He sat on a stage with me at the consumer conference that was run by Farzad, and he got to tell his story to thousands of people. Right? It just doesn't get better than that.
That's a terrific anecdote. I wanted to talk about innovation in itself.
Sure.
And you've said that the beautiful thing about innovation is that you always know where it starts, but you don't always know where it is going to end.
Correct.
Could you elaborate on that insight?
Well, let me give you an example. I mean, what if I told you that, you know, I had a way for you to very conveniently take all the stuff that you're filling out on a clipboard when you go to see your doctor, and I'm just going to digitize it for you so you never have to do that again, right? You'd say, well, it sounds okay. I'm not going to give you any money for it, but, you know, sure, it certainly would save me a few minutes and all the stuff that I don't have to remember, right? That's what Blue Button started out as, right? We were giving veterans back the information that they were giving because we weren't even touching the VISTA system. We were just telling them, oh, you're here to see the doctor. You're here because you have a sore throat. You're here because you want to, you know, refill your penicillin prescription, right? If you fast forward now just 2 years later, you know, a million users plus from my mouth to God's ears, we're going to get the other 313 pretty soon. Here's the thing that we couldn't have possibly predicted, that Blue Button becomes part of the meaningful use requirements for EHRs. You know, that Blue Button becomes the brand and the label that people know. Oh, when I see that silly little icon with the down arrow, oh, that's where I go to get health information, right? When we use this now as the place that we have the authoritative, clinically valid medical record, probably properly tagged, labeled, coded in a way that is completely interoperable at a data level. No, I actually wasn't thinking that when I asked the secretary if I could start. You know, that just kind of emerged in the fullness of time.
I have a twofold question, because it's around cultivating a risk-tolerant environment.
Yeah.
And does doing that, is that an essential characteristic of an effective chief technologist?
I think so, yeah. If you're going to play the safe role, if you don't have the personality, if you don't have the risk tolerance, if you don't have sort of like the emotional centeredness to say, oh, that was a bad idea. Perfect example. I met with one of the Presidential Innovation Fellows, and he's great, right? It's Matt McCall. He's coming to us from the outside. He's one of the guys who helped set us up in the open source platform. And man, that fur was flying, right? I mean, he wanted to make a left. I wanted to make a right. I'm older. He's younger. I've got more gray hair. He's got less gray hair. And I had to call him into the office, and I had to say, Matt, listen, I don't want to be a jerk about this. I'm just smarter than you. And he kind of looks at me like, well, maybe. So fast forward one day later, and we learn who is right. Because this is really black and white conversation, right? You either make a left on this or you make a right on this, right? And I am betting hundreds of dollars, hand in fire. I don't know what you're thinking. You're just thinking about it wrong. But he knew something I didn't know. And we come back and we reconvene because it's super urgent problem. We've got to get this solved right away. Otherwise, he can't keep coding. And I was absolutely positively wrong. I tell you, if you would have asked me when we were having that conversation, if you would have asked me, you know, who's right, I would have said, this is a joke. Can you add single digits in your head? He just having a bad day, right? And so I sat him down and we had this conversation. I said, hey, Matt, you remember yesterday, don't you? Right? And he's like, yeah. Right? I said, here's what I learned overnight. Here's the article that I read. Here's the person that I spoke to. Here's what you were trying to tell me that I didn't understand. And he's like, yeah, exactly right. I said, oh, you were right. Absolutely, you were right. Sorry about that, right? I completely agree with you now. Let's do it your way, right? Wow. All right. And so for a guy like me, it's like, well, I know more yesterday than I knew today. I understand better what he was trying to tell me. You know, I didn't put my ego into it. I was just trying to make a good technical decision. I was trying to give somebody who's 30 years younger than I am good technical advice. And guess what? He was right. So off you go. Here we go, right? It engenders such a trust, such a confidence, because the next time he fights with me, which is going to be the day after tomorrow when we, you know, encounter our next technical problem and he wants to make a right and I want to make a left, he's going to know that I am not pulling rank on him. I'm telling him what I really think. And then when I come back the next day after that, I hope it'll work out this way. I say, hey, this is what I read overnight. This is the person I spoke to. Here's the website I looked at. Here's how I can prove you are wrong. He's going to say, oh, I didn't know that, or I didn't realize that. Holy cow, I'm glad you figured that out so quickly, right? If you can do that with zero transaction costs, with zero emotion, with the enthusiasm and trust and mission orientation of your colleague, you'll be very successful. You don't need to be CTO. You can be anybody.
Well, before we close this conversation, it's been a wonderful conversation. I want to ask you, putting on your future hat, talk about the future a little bit.
Yeah.
What are some of the more promising emerging technologies that you see out there in the next couple of years?
The technologies that are emerging, I would say generically, right? There's, some of these will benefit the VA directly. Some of them sort of more indirectly, you know, fall into the categories of energy conservation and storage, right? So anything that has to do with batteries, anything that has to do with energy efficiency is hugely impactful. It has national security implications for our country. It has job creation implications for our country and has scientific implications, you know, how we teach the next generation. So that would be the first thing. The second is anything that has to do with education. I think that you're going to see a transformation right now in not the technology, which is itself pretty interesting in how we teach young people, but how we credential what they've learned. You know, you and I both came up sort of in this mechanism where, you know, you start in kindergarten when you're 5 or 6, and if you're good, you graduate when you're 17 or 18, and if you're lucky, you get to go to college. And what we're finding is not only is it too expensive to do that, it's not necessarily very effective, right? So you're going to see a whole bunch of new things coming along that will more precisely, in a more targeted way, teach people things that they're interested in, so curiosity-based learning, and things teach people things that they need to know in order to be successful in the marketplace. I am very, very optimistic about what's happening there. And, of course, the badging and the credentials that go along with that. And then last but not least is anything that has to do with healthcare, right? And so the way that I like to describe this to answer your question is today, right now, there are about 200 things that we can know about you. You know, how tall are you? How much do you weigh? What's your temperature right now? What's your heart rate right now? What's your blood pressure? What's your white cell count, right? You know, there's a bunch of things that I know how to ask, and let's say it's 200 of them, right? It's probably about that. So already tomorrow, we know that we're going to be able to take a snapshot of your blueprint, right? The design of your body is encoded in your DNA, and we know how to get to your DNA now for a few hundred dollars, right? Okay. Many people think, well, gee, if I know my DNA, I know who I am. That's actually not true. It's actually completely untrue. Now, if you have certain diseases that we've been able to deterministically correlate,